Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups for the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on Figliola v. School Board of the City of Harrisonburg, featuring Kate Anderson. Kate is Senior Counsel and Director of the Center for Parental Rights at Alliance Defending Freedom, where she works to ensure schools respect the role of parents in directing the upbringing, education, and health care of their children. Since joining ADF in 2015, she has defended the conscious rights of individuals being unjustly compelled to forfeit their beliefs under threat of government coercion in cases like Country Mill Farms v. City of East Lansing, 303 Creative v. Elanus, RG and GR Harris Funeral Homes v. EEOC, and more. Our moderator today is Sarah Parshall Perry. Sarah is a senior legal fellow in the Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation, where she focuses on civil rights, constitutional governments, regulatory policy, and the proper role of the courts. Previously, she served as senior counsel to the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Education. Sarah is a policy consultant and widely published author. She also frequently appears in numerous national and international media outlets and has testified multiple times before the U.S. House Judiciary Committee. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, thank you both for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thanks, Marco. Well, Kate and I are going to be talking today about something that is very near and dear to my heart, as those of us who are mothers can attest to, but also constitutional scholars. This is the intersection, I think, of one of the biggest areas of public policy and where it intersects with longstanding civil rights and constitutional law. This presents sort of an increasingly urgent question, and that is whether or not just parents have a constitutional right to know exactly how their children are identified at school, whether that be as their natal sex or otherwise, but also what the rights of those who are objecting teachers or administrators are to the proliferation of school policies that hide the minor's gender identity from their custodial parents. This is an interesting case, Figliola versus the School Board of Harrison County, Virginia. And this is a state law case, not a federal law case, but there were, of course, numerous implications for what we're seeing in federal law courts as well. And we're going to talk a little bit about those. But Kate, I am excited to have you on this webinar, and we have lots of ground to cover. So if you would, give us a little background on this particular case itself, the Figliola case, who the plaintiffs were involved, and what the claims were that ADF represented them on.
So this case started when the Harrisonburg Public Schools decided to train all of its teachers on this new policy that required every teacher to immediately ask every student for their preferred name and pronoun, always use that preferred name and pronoun, and keep it confidential from parents. So teachers were instructed specifically that not only did they have to participate in socially transitioning children at school, they had to hide that information from parents. This was of great concern to teachers and parents in the school district. And so three teachers approached us, along with one of those teachers is also a parent in the district. And then there was another family that joined them. And we filed a lawsuit in state court in Virginia to challenge this policy and ensure that teachers' rights were being respected, because it implicates, as we're going to talk about, the free speech and religious freedom rights of those teachers, but also that parents are respected, their parental rights and their free exercise rights as they go to raise their children.
Now, we normally see these cases that are postured specifically within the concept of parental rights solely. There are, of course, been sort of one-off litigation efforts specifically representing those objecting teachers and administrators, but there is, to a certain extent, and we understand this, obviously being both in this realm, that the sort of administrative policies of some of these schools operate as a bit of a sword of Damocles. And so a lot of these individuals are chilled in their expressions of speech or their objections to these particular policies. And the policies themselves, let me just talk about how extensive they are. We know that more than 12 million students in the United States are in school districts or in particular school environments that are specifically subject to overtly expressed non-discrimination policies that profess they will keep confidential a minor child's gender identity information from their parents on a child's say-so. Now, a couple of things about that. One of the things that we've seen represented is that this is a violation of FERPA, the particular privacy right that is held by the student. I'm using air quotes here, but we know that until a minor child reaches the age of 18, that FERPA privacy right is actually held by the parents to prevent intrusions upon family policy, as it's long been held and long been designed. A strict policy perspective question for you, Kate. The sort of expression of FERPA as being the putative basis for why these particular policies are necessary strikes me as either willfully ignorant or sort of wrongheaded because they are getting sort of poor counsel. I can't possibly believe that no one has done their homework on this precise issue and understands that that federal privacy law specifically dictates the privacy right be held by the parents of the minor child. Where do you think that disconnect lies?
I agree with you. This is just wrong thinking and wrong advice on what FERPA really requires. FERPA specifically, as you said, says that parents are the ones who hold that right for their children. And you even saw a federal judge in California deal with this particular issue, and I think rightly so, in the Mirabelli case, which, similar to the Harrisonburg case, was teachers raising this concern because these policies are all over the country, written policies and policies that are not always written, and they're being excused by things like FERPA. And there, the judge pointed out that the parent not only holds the right, but that it doesn't even make logical sense to say that FERPA would prevent the school from telling the parent, because what the school really wanted to do, and is true in Harrisonburg too, is tell everybody else in the school and in the public what this child wanted to be called while hiding that information from the parent. So it's the inverse of FERPA. I don't know why we can't quite get that right across the country, but it seems like that misinformation is out there and it needs to be corrected, because not only does the text of the statute answer this question, but logic should as well, that when you're keeping information from the parent only, that's the opposite of what FERPA is actually intended to do.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about sort of the parental rights analysis for this particular case. And we'll get a little further down the road to talk about why it wasn't included in the ultimate disposition of this case. And there are specific reasons for that. But I want to talk a little bit about the analysis in which many of these federal courts are getting wrong, and why we are finding so many federal courts who are saying the parents have no cognizable interest in this information that's being withheld from them, even though I think it is very clear that from Meyer versus Nebraska in 1923 all the way through Troxell versus Granville in the year 2000, the Supreme Court has a fairly robust tradition of enforcing and protecting parental rights. Now, it is itself rooted in that problematic substantive due process analysis from the 14th Amendment. We understand that while the justices are queasy about substantive due process, there are some rights that are pre-political, that predate the Constitution, either Virginia or the federal Constitution, that are natural rights that we have always recognized since time immemorial. But this particular analysis here presents some interesting questions at the intersection of parental rights. One of those is how to assess these particular school policies. And that is really where many of the judges are going wrong, are going awry. They are assessing them as legislative, or rather executive actions, executive actions that are specifically designed to sort of initiate, to demonstrate, to illustrate the actions of potentially one rogue actor within the concept of that individual's official duties. That, unfortunately, sets up the shield of qualified immunity that many of these litigants are unable to get past. So they're already losing at step one, which is, okay, these are deemed to be executive authority enforcements as opposed to legislative authority enforcements. So once we get to legislative authority exercises, as we know these school policies are, remember, many of these come from school boards themselves. They are school wide. All of the individuals who are enrolled at that school, all of the parents with children enrolled at that school, are subject to the exact same policy, unconstitutional though it is. And because of that, we're actually looking at a fundamental rights analysis, where here you would think there would be more hope for these litigants, because we know as recently as 2000, the Supreme Court in Troxell versus Granville, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said, we recognize this is the oldest of the fundamental rights ever acknowledged by this court. Now, that's significant. Again, we think we're headed down the right path, but unfortunately, now we've got the intersection of what is deemed to be more of an administrative or curricular or procedural determination of a particular school, as opposed to something in which, again, a parent would have a cognizable interest. So to your mind, if we have the judges, the rare federal courts who have gotten the first step of the analysis correct, we're down the legislative exercise of authority. We are looking at these through a fundamental rights lens. Where are we sort of unable to breach the divide between whether or not these are simply policies, simply administrative in nature, in which the parents would have no cognizable interest, and where, as sort of an oppositional approach, these would be directly related to a fundamental rights analysis and how a minor child identifies, which would be fully within the expression of the parental right?
So I think you're getting at an issue that we're seeing in the cases across the board on this. As you mentioned, parental rights is probably the oldest of the fundamental rights. And we have history going back. It's going to be 100 years this June from the landmark case, Pierce versus Society of Sisters, that said that parents have the fundamental freedom to direct their kids' upbringing and education. But as we've seen that right sort of be challenged in the context of these policies, it's made courts start to wrestle again with substantive due process, which is what you walked through. And the substantive due process claim is just not well written out. It's been really, they're still thinking through it, I think. And so the analysis that we're seeing happen is courts asking, okay, well, how do I analyze this? Do I look at whether it's a legislative function or an executive function? Traditionally, the executive function is where you have a rogue government official who has done something that they shouldn't have, that violated someone's rights, or the rogue police officer is the classic example that you see. But then you have this legislative function where the government should be held responsible under the Constitution, under strict scrutiny, when they are violating a right under that legislative function. And that, so trying to balance out what's a legislative function, what's an executive function. Some of the courts we've seen really haven't applied the test well. They're not sure what to do once they try to analyze what are the confines of that. I think very clearly in this context, this is a policy that the school has implemented. It's akin to a state statute or regulation, that kind of a function. This is a policy, and some of them are coming from the state regulatory level, but even if they aren't, this is a school saying this is the policy of the district to require teachers to use a preferred name and to keep that information from parents. So that falls thus in the legislative function. And then once you get there, you ask what kind of a right is being violated, a fundamental right or not. Parental rights has already been determined as a fundamental right. And then you get into the analysis of, well, what's the confines of that parental right, which is, I think, what you're kind of getting at the end of your discussion there. And I think we're still struggling with that a little bit as a society, coming from a long line of case law that was very unfavorable on curricular decisions of the school district and really leaned into school districts having full ability to administrate the school day. I think the heart behind that, if I'm going to give it any kind of a good grace, is that they wanted schools to be able to run effectively. And if too many parents are asking for too many things, it makes it hard to run the school. But that has to swing back, because that swung to a place where you had the Ninth Circuit saying that parents lose their rights at the schoolhouse gate. As soon as you drop your child off, you lose all of your rights to make decisions about their school day. And while that may have been less of a problem when the school was focused on classic reading, writing, arithmetic, the schools have broadened what they are focusing on. And now they're focusing on teaching social issues and issues that really get the heart of a student's identity, about their worldview, things that have traditionally always been within the purview of the parents. And so as you see that clash happening more and more, I think we need to define the edges better on what is a parental right to direct their kids' education and upbringing. And on this particular issue of socially transitioning a student, this goes right to the heart of who that student is, how they see the world. There are religious upbringing components of that. There are medical components of that, because in all of these cases, we're seeing experts come in and say even social transition is driving a child down a pathway towards medicalization on this issue. And there have been clear cases from the Supreme Court. Parham comes to mind, that said that when you get into medical decision making, that's within the purview of the parent, even when the child doesn't agree with the parent's decisions. This kind of a case, I think, puts us so squarely into what is the parental right that it should be an easy answer. And yet the courts are struggling at various places in the analysis. I will point out that the Foote decision that I think we want to talk about that just came out from the First Circuit, the First Circuit there was analyzing from the parents' perspective a case very much like our Harrisonburg case, where the school had socially transitioned a girl, middle school aged girl, without telling her parents, without asking their permission. And when they found out, they insisted on continuing it. So it raised all of the rights that we're talking about. There, the First Circuit, I think, as the courts have kind of struggled along the way, you see the later courts starting to get the analysis a little cleaner. And so the First Circuit very clearly walked through the analysis that you and I just did, that you look at whether it's a legislative function or an executive function, you look at whether it's a fundamental right. And they got this right, and then they got it so wrong, because they found that it was a fundamental right that was that warranted strict scrutiny. They went through that analysis. It was a legislative function. And then they just ignored so much of the plaintiff's pleading to say that the pleading was insufficient and didn't get you to allege the violation.
Yeah, it was really, I think, a frustrating outcome for any individual who is interested in not just constitutional law analysis, but also in parental rights as an increasingly important public policy issue, to come to the conclusion of no implication of parental rights. Because again, very much like Mirabelli, you know, there was an understanding, sort of a relinquishment of sort of any investment, any interest, any involvement in a child's public education once that child gets to the schoolhouse door. And in fact, in dicta, the court said specifically that there were other ways to identify where a child's gender identity was coming from, whether that was how that individual dresses or the social media your child consumes, which I think was rather flippant, a bit cast offish, I think, by the First Circuit. I do want to talk a little bit about the sort of increasing queasiness that the Supreme Court has, I think, or at least at the very minimum, it's a reticence to take up particular cases like this. Two, we saw on petitions for cert this past term, or this term itself, the Fourth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit both having cases identical, virtually in fact patterns. They were both facial challenges as opposed to as applied challenges. Do you think that indicates sort of the increasing receptivity to potentially taking a case like one that you and I have followed very closely out of the 11th Circuit, where this was both a facial and an as-applied challenge, the Little John versus Leon County School Board case, in which this was not just a facial constitutional challenge, but also one as applied to the plaintiff mother herself, because that child was facilitated in a social gender transition. And so she had two claims that she brought forth. Is it case like that, do you think, more ripe for Supreme Court review? Because I think at some point they are going to have to express their willingness to take up a very controversial issue rooted in, unfortunately, controversial due process doctrine.
I'm very hopeful that they will take a case soon. Those two cases went up on facial challenges. That's been another issue with the courts, that in addition to struggling with just the substantive due process analysis itself, the courts have really struggled with whether to decide these cases on a facial basis or required an as-applied challenge before they'll weigh in. And across the country, we've seen time and time again at the lower courts and now at the courts of appeals and now even at the Supreme Court, an unwillingness to take a facial challenge where parents see this kind of a policy. They step in ahead of time and say, I don't want this to hurt my kid. I don't want this to hurt any kid. So I'm going to challenge it now. And the courts have consistently said, well, if your child isn't harmed yet, we can't weigh in. And I hope that there's a change to that. I was a bit encouraged at the Seventh Circuit case against the Eau Claire School District. It did get a dissent from the denial of cert, where three justices said that they would have taken the case. Mm-hmm. And Alito wrote, really sending a message to lower courts that we need to engage on this issue. So I'm hopeful as you see more cases that could go up, there's several in courts of appeals that could work their way up to the Supreme Court, that the court will take one. Many of the cases that are going up are as applied challenges at this point, because I think there's been a shift in the strategy as well as just the reality of when you don't stop these policies on a pre-enforcement basis, you end up with kids who have been hurt, and then you end up with cases where their parents are coming into court saying, you've hurt my child with this policy and this needs to be stopped. We were able to win a case in the state court in Wisconsin with the help of Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, who led that case. And that was a win, but on an as-applied challenge. So I think you do see even that as an indicator that the state courts are more willing to weigh in on that as-applied basis.
So let's talk about the procedural posturing in the case at hand in the Figliola case and what happened to that parental rights claim.
Yes. So this was a pre-enforcement case as to the parents, because the parents didn't have a child who had been transitioned at school. They wanted to stop that from happening. And the court, like other courts, dismissed that claim. One of the interesting things that happened legally in the case is that we brought the claim under the state parental rights statute. So more and more states are passing these kinds of statutes saying that parental rights is fundamental under our state law, that it gets strict scrutiny, and defining some of the edges of that right. And it's been a really useful tool in a lot of states. But some of the states have them and they don't have a private right of action written into the statute. And that proved to be a problem for us in the Harrisonburg case, as well as in another case we filed in Virginia, where the court said there's no private right of action. You can't bring this claim under that statute. Fast forward a bit and we can skip back and then ahead again. But fast forward, and when we were able to resolve the case, the school district did agree to resolve that claim as well. It obviously had an appeal right. And so they resolved that claim by instructing the court and their school district that teachers would not be permitted to hide information or lie to parents.
So let's go back to the plaintiff teacher's claims in this particular case. You made a strategic decision to bring this under Virginia state law as opposed to bringing it under federal constitutional law. Talk to me a little bit about what that decision was informed by, and also what the associated state law claims were.
Yeah, so we brought claims under the state constitution because the state constitution is at least as protective. And then we later found out in the Vlaming case that we'll talk about that the Supreme Court sees it even more protective than the federal constitution. But the parental rights claim was a big part of the decision to file in state court. Even though it didn't pan out, there was much more clear instruction from that statute on how that claim would be analyzed. And we hoped to escape some of the concerns that we've been talking about with the federal substantive due process arguments. While with teachers' claims, their free speech and free exercise claims were as good or better in state court. And so we decided to file in state court.
You know, we've gotten a good question here on the issue itself of gender dysphoria, specifically related to the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, right? And whether or not, and we understand that I had a child with a 504 plan and I had a son with an IEP plan. So I'm fairly well versed in anti-discrimination law as concerns publicly funded education, but there is sort of an avenue there, understanding that the IDEA requires parental involvement for children who are specifically diagnosed with certain developmental or mental impairments. And yet, here we are with gender dysphoria, which would automatically, one would think, require parental involvement. But there seems to be a disconnect. We can't, unfortunately, get these particular expressions of gender identity covered by things like IEP plans, which is something obviously I also have had to walk through with my oldest son. So we protect other expressed disabilities to provide them an equal learning environment. All of these require parental involvement. But if we could get gender dysphoria under the IDEA to define it that way, would that be an option to sort of solve some of these complicated problems?
I think one of the tricky things that's happening is that these children are being socially transitioned at school without an actual diagnosis of gender dysphoria. So the school district is stepping in and saying, we're going to change your pronouns. We're going to change which restrooms you use. We're going to change the way that we treat you, and without parental involvement or even a diagnosis. So it's not triggering the federal protections in that way. And I think that would continue to be a problem. They would do it shy of there being an actual diagnosis to escape some of those requirements. But it brings to mind, we have a case in Michigan where the young girl was actually working through an IEP plan with her parents because she had autism. And they were working very, very closely with the district about trying to address her social, emotional, and particularly her educational issues at school to try to really help her grow. And despite that constant communication, working through that plan with the school district hid from those parents that they were simultaneously treating this girl as if she were a boy at school, changing her name, her pronouns, et cetera, without telling the parents. And it even went so far as the counselor who was involved in both the social transition and the IEP plan was changing the names on documents that went home to the parents, documents related to the IEP plan, to change her name back to her real name to hide that information for months from the parents. They only found out because she missed a quote unquote correction in the document. And so they realized what was going on. So it's even happening in the context of an existing IEP plan process.
So in the litigation here in Figliola, what was the ultimate disposition here on your way to the Supreme Court? That is my sort of secondary question. Let me back up and ask you what I think is a question that some of our listeners and our viewers may be interested in as well, because ADF had a significant win in the Vlaming versus West Point School Board case, which was, again, a preferred pronoun, compelled speech case, specifically for a French teacher, middle school French teacher, and his required use of preferred pronouns. Again, he also, under state constitutional law, expressed his desire not to violate his own faith and not to be compelled to transmit messages with which he disagreed. Was that instructive in your desire to bring these claims under state law? And how close do you think the analysis was in this case?
Yes, it very much was. And I think it illustrates how these cases work together. And you can see the court moving in the right direction on these issues. The Harrisonburg case was brought while the Vlaming case was still pending. So they weren't necessarily related in how we filed them, but they ended up coming together for a good resolution for Harrisonburg. We were able to settle the Harrisonburg case with the school district because the Vlaming decision came out as a win in favor of free speech and religious freedom. And there, that case went up to the Virginia Supreme Court, the Virginia Supreme Court had a chance to weigh in on analysis of its constitutional provisions and spent quite a time in that case. I recommend the case because I think it's so interesting on this point, really walked through the history of the state constitution and the analysis there to say that it is more protective on free speech and religious freedom than its federal counterpart, but at least coextensive, and then went ahead to analyze Mr. Vlaming's situation in a way that would have resulted in a win, I think, under the federal constitution as well, but said that when a teacher is required to use a preferred name or a preferred pronoun that violates their religious convictions, that that violates the compelled speech doctrine, and both the free exercise clause and the state RFRA in Virginia. So seeing that and seeing how similar the fact patterns were in both cases, Harrisonburg School District was able to resolve the case with us while we were on a pending motion for summary judgment in the state court. And the resolution resulted in a order filed with the court stating that it is the policy of Harrisonburg not to require any teacher to use preferred names or pronouns, to ask for those pronouns, or to hide information from parents. They also passed a religious accommodation policy a little bit earlier in the litigation and affirmed that that would be a secondary mechanism for teachers in the district to seek clarity and potential accommodation if they were still concerned about the requirements of either the discrimination, harassment policies, or any other policies in the district. So it was a great result for the school because it ensures that teachers are going to be free on these issues and that parents are going to be able to walk alongside their kids, because I think that's something to note here when we're talking about the policies, is that they really serve parental rights because these kids are struggling with real things that they need their parents to walk alongside with them and be present in this struggle. And when the school prevents the parents from having the information, it really keeps those kids from having their parents there to walk alongside these issues with them.
Have you found that the sort of Pickering bright line analysis of whether or not an individual, a teacher, is speaking in a public or official capacity has played into your litigation in these particular cases, or on a sort of a more macro level in these cases specifically related in federal courts to the notion of having to be compelled, even though it's violative of the Constitution, to speak messages or to transmit ideas with which one doesn't agree? Now, we got a great result in the Meriwether versus Hartop case coming out of the Sixth Circuit. Amul Thapar wrote a tremendous piece about the fact that while this individual, this professor at Shawnee State University, was in an official capacity when he was speaking, he was speaking about something in which there is public interest. It is a public concept, something up for debate, something about which reasonable minds can often very much disagree. And because of that, because this is something that is obviously in the public eye, entirely debatable, that shouldn't play into this particular, that should rather play into this particular analysis, because this individual was speaking in accordance with his beliefs on that precise public issue. But have you all in your litigation run into a Pickering stop sign on getting to the point of whether or not this is an issue about which individuals can be communicative without being forced to compel one message or another?
We see the school districts raising the issue, like in Meriwether, and it came up in Vlaming as well. And the Vlaming court walked through the analysis very much like you just did and said that while this is a teacher in their duties as a teacher, this is a matter of public concern. And whether they are, when they're speaking about this particular issue, it's on the edge of whether or not that's their official duty to use the preferred name, and really weighed that balancing test and said that it was in the teacher's favor there as well as in the Meriwether case.
So is your hope that cases like this, and I can perhaps anticipate the answer, but is your hope that cases like this are going to be, while onerous in terms of the burden for you litigators, really the only opportunity to be able to provide some control, some guardrails around these particular school policies, if we both see parental litigation and we both see teacher and administrator litigation, both of which now we've got sort of the panoply of constitutional issues, whether under state law or under federal law, that it's litigation like this against specific school policies that's going to be essentially the opening salvo on getting these schools to roll back policies because they are so patently unconstitutional.
I think we have to win this issue for kids and for parental rights. I think it's an issue that very squarely puts in front of the courts the parental right and the confines of that right and how important it is, even in the school district. We have to break down this idea that parents' choice is public school, private school, or homeschool. But once they drop their kids at the schoolhouse gate, they lose all rights. But whether litigation is the only way to beat this issue, I don't know. I think that there are a lot of things working together here. You see the administration coming in with some very powerful executive orders, rolling back some of the guidance from the last administration and before that told school districts they had to follow some of these types of policies when it comes to restrooms and private spaces. And I think you're going to see OCR take some action, potentially talking to some schools about these policies. So it seems like it's a lot of it working together. You also see many parents standing up and pushing back on their schools at school board meetings, and school board members, new members that came in with the last election, that are also concerned about these issues. So I think you're going to see the change. The litigation sort of brought the issue, I think, to light to people, and will continue to push it because I think we are headed towards a Supreme Court case saying the school districts cannot socially transition kids without telling their parents or over their parents' objections. But in the meantime, I think you're seeing a lot of action from the current administration and a lot of local action from grassroots groups that is making a significant difference across the country.
You know, I think we've seen sort of the clash of state anti-discrimination law against federal constitutional jurisprudence. And I'm sort of moving out of the bucket in state constitutional law back to the federal level, because we've obviously seen a number of times in which the Supreme Court, and obviously, you know, full well, 303 Creative versus Alenis, no law is immune from the bounds of the First Amendment. And the anti-discrimination provisions in Colorado state law, very much like, for example, what Maine has now expressed under Maine's Human Rights Act as the professed reason for sort of their intractability on following the executive order and federal case law now on Title IX and women's athletics. It seems to be, once again, sort of this purported shield for bad actors in the states themselves who were saying, well, we're bound by the sort of regulation of state law and our own anti-discrimination provisions, which, again, seems not only constitutionally incorrect, but also seems to be sort of a weak legal argument on which to rely. Where do you think those sort of provisions come from? That sort of desire of many of the blue state governors to hold fast to state anti-discrimination law, despite what we know now is an absolute dearth of federal case law to the contrary. And now with the cover of federal executive orders, which will be concretized in ultimate federal regulations. And I have to tell you, for the regulators at the OCR offices, I don't envy them. They're going to have their work cut out for them. It is a bit of a game of regulatory ping pong at present. What do you think is sort of the desired outcome for these particular states who are willing to gamble, like Maine has, with, for example, $250 million of federal funding for her refusal to follow what you and I both know to be constitutionally correct?
Feels like a bold move to take that position, Maine. But I just think you're seeing states really dig in on their own beliefs about their own laws, and they're misunderstanding some of the motivation and balance of rights. When they're willing to force a website designer in Colorado to create same-sex websites when she can't speak that message, no matter who asks her for it, when she has in the record and they agreed to the testimony that she serves all people and that she creates work for all people, That's a high level of constitutional violation that you're willing to compel speech. And I think people need to think through that if you give a state government that kind of power to violate constitutional rights in one context, they're going to take it in another. And that's why the Constitution is there, to protect everybody's freedom at these most important and fundamental levels. We need to be able to speak freely so that we can learn and disagree and grow as a society. Religious freedom is important for everybody. And we all know how important these constitutional positions are. And we have to protect them, even in the face of state laws and state policies that are pushing certain agendas at this point.
Hey, thank you so much for joining me today. Thanks for the work that you all are doing at the Center for Parental Rights at Alliance Defending Freedom, and have really enjoyed our discussion today. If our viewers or listeners want to get a hold of you, what is the best way to do that?
You can reach me at adflegal.org. You can follow all of our websites. On there have information about our growing cases, and we post information about really the different filings with the courts and what's going on in the cases. So it's easy to follow our work there.
Thanks again, Kate. And with that, this FedSoc Forum is adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.